I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today about e-waste, old TVs and cell phones showing up in landfills of poor countries, maybe sitting in your attic leaking toxins. But first, we have some breaking news. The Supreme Court today cleared the way for executions to resume across the country. The court ruled that the most common method of lethal injection does not violate the Constitution. In other words, is not cruel and unusual punishment. Two death row inmates in Kentucky challenged the procedure, in which three drugs are used to first sedate, then paralyze, and then kill. The inmates claim that if the first drug does not work, the next can cause excruciating pain, but the prisoner is unable to express that pain. Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for SCOTUSblog.com. Lyle, a highly anticipated ruling. What do you think its significance is, just in and of itself?
Well, in and of itself, I don't think this ends the debate about the lethal injection method itself. Or at least it does not end the debate about how that three-drug protocol is used.
Well, it was a 7-2 ruling. You describe it as widely splintered. What was the dissent?
Well, the dissent was only by Justice Ginsburg and Souter. The other seven justices have come out sustaining Kentucky's method of execution.
But what does that mean about other states?
Other states probably can get by with using the same three drugs. But what it may mean is that other states may have to examine the process by which they administer them. For example, how well do they train the people who do the injections? How well do they monitor the condition of the inmate as the process goes forward? There very likely will be new constitutional challenges trying to fit the challenges within the new standard that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion lays down.
We should say that this case that came before the Supreme Court from Kentucky was from two death row inmates who didn't ask to be spared execution. They were asking the court to switch to a single drug.
That was kind of their belated suggestion for an alternative. Chief Justice Roberts' opinion rejects that as an alternative, saying that is an untested alternative.
Well, and these inmates from Kentucky based their case on executions that had gone wrong in Florida and Ohio, where workers, you know, had trouble inserting IV lines and prisoners suffered severe pain. But the judges didn't seem to be moved by that.
I think what the judges had said is that in this particular case, these inmates did not show that this particular state, that is Kentucky, has a procedure that's likely to fail the new standard. And the new standard is, will the method contain or present a substantial risk of serious harm?
So, Lyle, do we have an estimate of how many executions there might be? I mean, what are we talking about in numbers of executions that were on hold or maybe weren't even drawn up?
I think we are probably, at a minimum, talking about a couple of dozen. It may be scores of inmates whose execution, the dates will now be reset as a result of this decision. Because I think it's important to point out that while the Supreme Court has not allowed any execution to go forward while it considered this case, it never did issue a nationwide moratorium. So I think that we are likely to see in some states, particularly, let's say, a state like Texas and a state like Alabama, which are quite eager to begin to resume executions, will move forward quite rapidly.
And what does this case mean, if anything, for that overarching question of whether or not the death penalty will be abolished? If these seven justices don't find this three-drug protocol cruel and unusual punishment, does that pretty much, you know, send the signal that this court will never overturn the death penalty?
I think one could probably expect, as a general matter, that the court is not yet ready to do that. But given the way judges do these things, Robin, I think it's important to emphasize, as Justice Alito pointed out in one of the separate opinions, that we are not now facing the question of whether the death penalty itself is unconstitutional. And Justice Stevens seems to be suggesting that the court at some point should take up that issue. But the court was quite careful to say, do not read this opinion as giving any indication of where we are on that ultimate issue about whether the death penalty itself is unconstitutional.
Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for Here and Now and for SCOTUSblog.com. We'll link you at our website, here-now.org. Lyle, thanks.
Delighted to be with you again.
60 cities in America and Canada are participating in a free electronic waste collection event this weekend, and a leading toxic waste watchdog group says, be careful. The group BAN says unless the organizers of the April 19th Collection Day can prove that your old computers, cell phones, and TVs are going to responsible recyclers, those items may end up in a landfill in a third world country to be torn apart and resold by captive prison labor or kids scrambling over toxic landfills. So we're going to have a link at our website to a list that BAN calls credible e-waste recyclers. But right now, a look at the problem they're trying to avoid. About 25 million TVs are thrown away every year, and there will be more as Americans switch to high-definition TV. In 2005, Americans threw out 98 million cell phones. In fact, according to the UN Environment Program, the world generates 50 million tons of so-called e-waste every year. And much ends up overseas. Chris Carroll traveled to Ghana and China for National Geographic magazine to document the problem. Chris, can you first just describe what you saw? Because we can all imagine, you know, a trash dump on a street corner or something. But these scenes are huge. Just describe one.
Well, in China, in the southern province that I was in, south of Shanghai, I saw mountains of waste. It wasn't all e-waste, but, you know, there was electronic waste mixed in, and you would have a hard time climbing these things if you wanted to. They were brought in by ships from all over the world and just dumped at the port, and entrepreneurs from the area would come in and truck all of it away and back to these recycling mills where people from the area would just kind of take it all apart.
And what's the danger of that? I mean, remind us, you know, they're taking it apart with their bare hands.
Yeah, they're breaking it apart with hammers, pulling it apart with their bare hands, using improvised tools in some cases. And the danger is that some of these things have chemicals in them that are toxic. Even if they're in fairly low levels, continual exposure every day for years to this stuff, which is the situation these people are in, can probably have some fairly devastating effects.
In fact, you write that high levels of flame retardants that are common in electronics were found in plants, animal soils, and the blood of workers in a city south of Shanghai. So it's happening.
It's not really known exactly what the effects of those flame retardants are, but there's more and more evidence growing that there are reproductive problems resulting from these, possible cancer. There's a growing body of evidence suggesting that it is harmful, and the stuff is everywhere there.
Well, what is the law, both in China and internationally? I mean, we understood China prohibited the import of electronic waste in 2000, so tell us about that. And then further, isn't there international law?
Well, China has issued a succession of edicts about this stuff, and it is essentially illegal to bring in electronic waste or hazardous waste. But the central government of China isn't in every port policing this stuff. A port that I went to, I saw some customs inspectors opening shipping containers coming in, but nevertheless, it gets through. Sometimes shippers will hide it behind stuff in the front of the crate, and in the back they'll have the old computers or monitors or whatever.
Well, and what about the international law? I mean, isn't there some restriction on this?
There's an international treaty called the Basel Convention that is supposed to stop countries in the developed world that have signed on to this treaty from shipping hazardous waste to countries in the developing world. The United States is not part of that. We've never ratified it. And even in countries that have ratified it, for instance, the European Union, it still gets out. I mean, there's such an incentive to get this stuff out of wealthy countries because it's expensive to recycle. There's not much value in it from the standpoint of a wealthy country. And so in the developing world, where people make far less money, there is some profit in it for poor people.
It sounds as if some of the people shipping it overseas, you know, running the containers, sound like pretty shady characters, but other people along the chain are not. You were able to track how some of this e-waste got to a garbage heap in Ghana from a Goodwill store right near your house in Frederick, Maryland. What'd you find?
When I was doing some reporting in Ghana, I went into a little storefront where I saw they had a lot of old cathode ray tube computer monitors. And on a number of them, I found tags that identified this store near my house. And so a few weeks later, when I was back in the U.S., I called the business associate of the store owner who actually sent these things to Africa. He essentially goes around and buys up lots of monitors or lots of old computers and loads them into a shipping container and every month or so ships it. It costs about $6,000 to ship it, and he makes some kind of profit off of it. You know, he's not some kind of mafia type figure. He is a handyman over in Alexandria, Virginia, at an apartment complex there, and he does it just to feed his family, basically.
The Pentium 3 brings $150 in Accra, Ghana.
Right.
And he can buy these machines for $10 on internet liquidation websites.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes that cheap. The problem is, though, that he buys them in these large lots, and he lives in a small apartment, and he's not some kind of computer technician. So he doesn't test things before he sends them. He boxes them up and sends them. And when they arrive, his brother and business associate opens the container, takes them out, and when he tries to fire them up, he finds that a lot of them do not work at all. And so what he does then is he just throws them out by the curb. A little while later, some guys come by with a cart. They buy these things for pennies, and they cart them to a local scrap market. Then they sell those in turn to people who live and work at this market. And these are extremely poor people. A lot of them are refugees from around Ghana and from different places in Africa who live in tiny, horrible shacks. They buy these things, and this is probably the worst thing I saw in my travels. They'll smash them up with a stick or a hammer or something, pull out this copper wiring from inside the computer, and just burn it on top of a tire with this thick black smoke just rising. The people doing the work are often small children, and they're just standing in the smoke, which is filled with dioxin and different kinds of dangerous toxins. And they do this every single day of their lives, don't go to school. And then they take the copper that is with the flame retardant insulation burned off of it, then they can sell it. And, you know, maybe get 50 cents or a dollar for it. Then they use that to buy more computer parts and keep doing the same thing and just scraping by, not making much money.
When Boyd tells you the gas goes to your nose, you sometimes feel something in your head. Then you get sick in your head and chest. So it's bad enough what it's doing for the people. But you also point out that the rain is going to wash all of this out into the ocean later that day. So it just...
That's right. When they finish smashing up the monitor or the computer, the leftover parts are often just thrown into a drainage ditch nearby. I was there during the rainy season. One day I saw a bunch of stuff in the ditch. I went to the same place a couple days later after there had been some extreme rains that caused bad flooding around Accra. And the drainage ditch was mostly empty, and that thing flushes right out into the Atlantic.
Well, there are companies that have sprung up. You talk about some of them that are trying to change the way we dispose of e-waste, and we'll talk about that. But you're writing this article. You're working on your computer. Do you view it differently?
I do, you know, and one thing I thought about as I was working on this, I actually have an old Mac sitting in my basement that I need to get rid of. I have no use for it. There's no easy way to get rid of it. Because of the reporting I've done, I actually know a place that I can take it. And the point is, it'll cost me $30 or $40 plus a two-hour drive to recycle this computer. It is not free by any means. In the United States, there's just no easy answer. If you want to dispose of your electronic waste responsibly, you have to pay to do it. It's a little bit different in Europe, where they kind of add in at the front end of purchasing this stuff a tax that will cover the recycling at the end. But here, it's out of your pocket.
Chris Carroll, his article about high-tech trash in developing countries appears in the National Geographic magazine. We can link you to it at our site, here-now.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
So Chris points out that a lot of this e-waste is being recycled. It's coming back to the U.S. from China in the form of toxic toys and jewelry. What to do? Well, just ahead, the Recycler Pledge. Later today, a solemn anniversary. Back in a minute, here and now. We've been talking about electronic waste from wealthy countries like the U.S. being dumped in developing countries instead of being responsibly recycled. High-tech gadgets have a lot of chemicals in them and are hard to dispose of. But there are organizations springing up to address the issue. We mentioned BAN, and we'll have their list of responsible recyclers at our website. But there's also the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition in California. Sheila Davis is the executive director. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you.
Sheila, what prompted the birth of this organization 25 years ago?
25 years ago, there was actually chemical spills in some of the neighborhoods in San Jose. Some of the largest companies that were early manufacturers of electronics, like IBM and Fairchild, were using underground tanks to store their chemicals, and those chemicals seeped into the water supply. And at that point, the neighbors were pretty outraged, and they were very concerned. And so they came together with some local policymakers, as well as firefighters, and a lot of people that were concerned about the type of chemicals that were being used, and started Silicon Valley Toxics.
Well, and that helps these products maybe at the beginning of their life. But what are you now doing to ensure that at the end of life, when these things are thrown away, they don't go into our water and other elements?
A couple things. One is that there's really no good way to recycle electronics right now. There's quite a bit of value in the products. There's, of course, gold and silver and copper, and then there's high-grade plastics and glass. But because of the chemicals that they're using to make them, they are very low value because they're so toxic. And because they are so labor-intensive to get apart, they can't be recycled. So we realized that they were being sent overseas to be recycled, as you mentioned earlier. And one of the things that we felt would prevent that from happening is if manufacturers took responsibility for recycling their electronics properly. And that would, one, reduce the desire or the need to put chemicals in it because it would be too costly for them to continue to use chemicals. And two, they would also be able to do it properly so that they're not sent overseas. This is already happening in the European Union. There is a directive there that requires manufacturers to take back their computers and recycle them. Unfortunately, there's still loopholes, and they still send some of the computers overseas for recycling.
Well, we know that here in the U.S., you've worked with states that have passed legislation requiring that companies be responsible for their product from start to finish. Maine is one. If you make it, you have to also, in Maine, ensure that in its life cycle it doesn't pollute.
Exactly. Maine is one of the states that has manufacturer responsibility, as well as Washington State. More than a dozen states have passed some type of legislation.
But how do you safely recycle it here?
Well, it's really difficult because, again, there are not any standards for recycling in this country, and that's one of the things that we're working on. So when you send it to a recycler, you think that they're doing the right thing with it, but you really don't know. And so one of the things that you can do, of course, is see whether or not the recycler signed a recycler pledge. That's a pledge of stewardship so that they're not shipping them overseas. And the other thing that you can do, of course, is ask them what they're doing with their materials.
Well, we know one of the goals is, as you said, to make products less toxic in the first place, but right now they are. So are there, you know, compounders that exist that can take out some of the valuable material? I mean, where do they go? If they're toxic, is there an attempt to extract the toxic part out? What happens?
Well, one of the things that recyclers do is they'll try to dismantle it and recover some of the valuable parts. The integrated circuit boards will go to smelters. For example, there's copper smelters and there's lead smelters, and they actually recover the valuable material. The plastics will go to plastic recycling. One of the unfortunate things that's happening is that the products still aren't very well designed so that they can be dismantled, so you can segregate the parts and get the valuable parts, separate them from the unvaluable parts. What they do is now put them in a big grinder, and they're grinding it all, and then they have processes that they try to separate it after they grind it. So you have this big, what they call a fluff of metals and plastics and glass all mixed together, and then through a water separation process or an air separation process or using magnets, they'll try to pull out the valuable parts. Well, unfortunately, there's still a lot of waste in that process. So we want the companies to redesign the products so they can get maximum value at the end of life.
You're very concerned that people who are doing this work are paid living wages and they have some sort of protection under OSHA, you know, that they wear protective gear, that they're protected from what they're working with.
Exactly. And again, there's not very many standards in electronic recycling. And so we are trying to enforce the standards, and we're trying to get companies to do some type of monitoring and, of course, OSHA and EPA so that we know exactly what workers are being exposed to. And we also are trying to get the recycling not to happen in U.S. prisons. Of course, the prisoners get paid anywhere from $1 to $1.25 or less an hour to recycle, but they don't have any of the safeguards that you just mentioned, and they don't have any of the labor protections from the federal government. So it's just a bad idea to have it recycled by prisoners.
I'm just wondering, you know, we've gotten used to having our computers, more than one. Do you think the large number of Americans just think, I'll just put that computer out on the curb?
Well, I don't think that most Americans feel that way, because typically what happens is if you have an old computer, more than likely you just don't set it on the curb. You probably put it in your closet thinking maybe a relative or somebody else can use it, or there's just some type of aversion, I think, to actually just tossing it in the garbage, because I think people intuitively know that there's a lot of value in it and that they also spent a lot of money for it. When they try to do the right thing and send them to a recycler, It's kind of like the out of sight, out of mind approach. You put it in the recycling bin and you really don't think what happens after that.
When in fact your recycler may be sending it to some poor village in China.
Exactly.
Sheila, this is a problem that I would think is only going to get worse as we come up on legislation that's going to make so many televisions, for instance, obsolete.
Very true. And there's going to be a lot of waste from televisions next year this time when we switch from analog to digital. People will definitely be purchasing a lot of new televisions and getting rid of their old televisions. It's important that everyone let manufacturers of these televisions know that they want the televisions recycled properly, that they don't want this type of waste to go overseas. Television companies are already making kind of slow moves to recycle as a response to consumer demand.
Sheila Davis, again, Executive Director of the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition. Thanks for speaking with us, Sheila.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, quick look ahead. We're going to have reaction to tonight's debate between Senators Obama and Clinton in Pennsylvania. Also, deranged chic, that's the latest trend in fashion advertising. It conflates mental illness and sex appeal. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, author Jhumpa Lahiri. That's after the news, Here and Now. On the drill field of Virginia Tech, flowers, personal mementos, and handwritten notes adorn 32 engraved stones. The stones are in memory of the students and professors killed 1 year ago today when 23-year-old Chosung Hui went on a shooting rampage before taking his own life. This morning, the university held a commemoration, which included remarks by Virginia Governor Tim Kaine.
The world was cheated on April 16th a year ago. Cheated out of the accomplishments that were surely to come from these extraordinary lives.
Washington Post reporter Nick Miroff is covering today's events. Nick, what's it like on campus?
It's a very somber mood. This is an anniversary I don't think anyone has been looking forward to. It's a time when a lot of students are going to have to face some old feelings that they've maybe buried or put in the backs of their minds. At the same time that they want to remember what happened here and not allow the people who were killed a year ago to fade away, they know that they need to move on. As a result, I think many of them are struggling with how to remember but not have to experience the kind of trauma they felt a year ago.
You know, we're hearing so many stories today about other colleges instituting text messaging systems for cell phones and requiring security guards. A grad student in film at USC writes today in the New York Times that her school is discouraging students from putting guns in student films because to film on campus with a gun could lead to a problem. All of this, because of Virginia Tech a year ago. What has changed at Virginia Tech?
A lot has changed, and in many ways, it's still the same place. Students tell me that they still go to football games. They still feel like they're going to a normal American university and are able to enjoy themselves. But there's an edginess now, and teachers will lock classroom doors. Text alerts will go out to students' cell phones whenever there's a crime of some kind. And it's always, I think, in the back of people's minds. People say they still feel safe. But at the same time, there is an awareness there that life is fragile and that, you know, random and terrible acts of violence do happen, and they happened here.
What's happened to Norris Hall, where the shootings took place?
Norris Hall is still being used as a classroom space. The engineering department made a conscious decision to reclaim that space and, you know, to honor their colleagues by not leaving. At the same time, the classrooms where the killings occurred are now deadbolted shut. The hallway where many students died has been repainted and scrubbed clean. So there are no physical traces. So if you talk to students, they'll tell you that when they walk by the building, it's hard not to think about what happened inside.
We understand a new Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention is planned for an area of Norris Hall. Nick, you point out that very soon there won't be students on campus who were witness to what happened a year ago because they've graduated. How are the freshmen dealing with all of this? They weren't there.
They have a difficult time. On the one hand, I think they're curious about what happened, but at the same time, they have to walk on eggshells when they bring it up. Some freshmen told me that it's something that's only safe to discuss in the company of other freshmen because you don't know what memories or what experiences someone else had, and you're afraid to ask about them. So they represent the ability of this campus to move on with time, so I think they play a kind of therapeutic role in many ways, too.
Nick Miroff of The Washington Post, thanks so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, in addition to the 32 people killed at Virginia Tech, over 20 were wounded, including Garrett Evans. He was a 30-year-old economics senior. He was shot several times in the legs. Here's how he described the shooter right afterwards.
Walks in the door real fast. Didn't say anything. All he did was bang, 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 bang. Shot a girl here, shot a girl there, shot the instructor. Along the way, he ran out of rounds, emptied his magazine, slipped in another one. In a matter of 1.5, 2 seconds, went back to work. Bang, bang, bang.
Well, Garrett Evans joins us now on the line from his native Chicago. Garrett, how are you doing today? Is this harder than others?
Believe it or not, it's not that bad, simply because I don't have any unanswered questions about it. It happened. We all have a choice. We could either stay down in the dumps about it, which it could easily happen, because I tell you, it is a rough situation. I mean, it's hard to forget. It's impossible. Or we could use that situation and remember it, learn from it, and find ways to make the world a better place.
We know you've been talking to young people about violence. What kind of things are you doing? What are you saying?
I tell them, I mean, there are other ways to resolve issues. Society's kind of in a little bit in a state of chaos. Look at all the people that have shot people. It's because they were hurt, they were angry, basically mentally, emotionally, and spiritually discombobulated. And what I do is also go to speak to people about my experience and how we need to have tougher laws. Keep the guns out of hands of people with records, people with mental illnesses, as well as children. So,
reading the accounts that you gave after you were shot, you were in the hospital, and you gave some accounts of what you saw. I mean, you were eyewitness to three students holding the door shut so that the shooter who had gone out couldn't come back in. You saw his face. You've learned to live with that, it sounds like. You've learned to live with those images in your head?
Strength of God, power of God, yes, is the only way. The thing that makes it a little tougher is the fact that I'm still carrying a bullet. And every now and then I could feel it. Doesn't hurt that bad, but I just know it's there. Didn't hit a vein, didn't hit an artery, didn't hit a bone. And the hollow point bullet's still in one piece. So from all of that, I've learned to count my blessings a whole lot more.
Do you plan on taking a moment today to, I mean, obviously you're talking about the day, but do you plan on having a private moment today to think about it, or is it?
It's always private time to think about it, but today I'm going to Nationwide Lie-In in downtown Chicago.
Tell us about this. This is a protest in Chicago, a lie-in. People literally going to lie on the ground?
Oh, yeah. All over the country. It's in 30-something states, give or take.
And what's your goal?
Basically, express my concern for all the people that have just been dying so rapidly because people have been shot. So many kids. 9 of them out of 10 had a future to be doctor, lawyer, minister, politician. They all had plans. I have a friend of mine. His son died. Took one bullet to rights out of his chest. He died. But I have another friend who just had the anniversary of his son shooting 2 years ago. I have a lot of friends who lost children and friends who lost friends. That's the biggest reason I decided to make the choice between sitting on the sidelines and playing ball. And I do is just go to speak to people and tell them, hey, look, this has to end.
You know, you're talking about plans derailed. We know you were an older student, and you'd studied economics and statistics at Virginia Tech and had planned to go into banking.
That was the plan. That was what I wanted to do. But you know what? Maybe that's not the plan. What we have planned and what our calling is, they're both different. And the main thing is, if you're called to do something, you have to do it. With the gun violence, somebody has to do it.
That's Garrett Evans. He survived the shooting at Virginia Tech last year. As he said, he's participating in the National Lie-In today. He's in Chicago to draw attention to gun violence. Garrett, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Tonight in Philadelphia, a week before the crucial Pennsylvania primary, Democrats Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton meet again in their first debate in nearly 2 months. It's too early to say if Obama has lost any ground in the polls because of his remarks about small-town Americans bitter about job losses, clinging to guns and religion. But Pennsylvania is a state where Hillary Clinton used to have a commanding lead, and both senators are now essentially running neck and neck. And voters there still have questions. Here's just two, starting with a laid-off factory worker.
My name is Aaron Stewart from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. We have a lot of steel here that has been taxed and tariffed for so long, and we can't sell it anywhere in the world. I would ask, as president, what would you do, what steps would you take to ensure fair trade?
My name is Susan Hill. I'm an attorney in Central Pennsylvania, and I would ask Hillary Clinton how she plans to use the talents and experience of Bill Clinton in her administration.
Dick Pullman is national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dick, what questions are you hearing? Are people still asking about real issues, or is it all about recent comments or who can hunt?
Well, you know, it kind of goes on two tracks. I mean, clearly people here really want some specifics from Clinton and Obama, particularly in these small towns, which I think is the first tape that you played, indicates. I mean, people are looking for some real answers because these communities have been depressed for so long, and every administration from both sides of the aisle have hurt them. So they're looking for some, you know, they'd like some substance here. But it is going on two tracks because of Obama's recent comment last week that everybody's been sort of replaying and debating, that does also hit some people on a visceral level. So they get this idea, many of them get this idea that specifics and policies aside, you know, is this guy one of us, or does this guy understand us? And so this notion that, people are so-called clinging to religion, it has offended some people, and it's probably making his job a little bit tougher, at least among some of these working-class voters who he would like to turn.
Well, you've written that Hillary Clinton went into blue-collar overdrive over the weekend to court middle-class and small-town voters. She memorably drank some beer and downed a shot in an Indiana bar on Sunday. And now Barack Obama is also speaking quite a bit about his humble beginnings, mentioning how his single mom was once on food stamps. But when I was in Pennsylvania recently and talked to potential voters, they said, you know what, we don't really think that we matter. There still is the feeling that it's just going to be Pittsburgh and Philly that's going to determine the ultimate primary.
Well, I mean, the Philadelphia area, I mean, there's some truth to that. I mean, certainly, I mean, the Philadelphia area, Philadelphia and the surrounding suburbs, the counties immediately surrounding Philadelphia, something like 40 or 45% of the vote statewide could just come out of this region where I'm speaking from. I mean, this is really the most populous region of the state. And so it has a sort of an outsized advantage or impact. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton also has, she has a decent amount of support in these very populous suburbs, particularly among women. So I think it still comes down to, even though these towns feel neglected and they don't feel like they're going to have so much to say in this primary, I think they actually potentially do. I mean, in the swing vote, are these small town, working class, culturally conservative, many of them, voters. And they're still, I understand, making up maybe about 30-35% of the electorate here as well.
So, Dick, I'm going to be unfair. We've got about a minute left. Speaking for them, perhaps, what's the one question you would ask the candidates tonight?
The one question would be, what can either of them do differently than President Bush or President Clinton, for that matter? Because those regions, the depressed regions, weren't doing well under him either. So, what specifically can they do that's differently, and how much political capital would they expend on that if they have a Democratic Congress?
To improve the economy, bring back jobs. Dick
exactly.
Pullman, national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, will be listening. Dick, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a minute break, and up next, author Jhumpa Lahiri, Here and Now.
In her much-loved books, The Interpreter of Maladies and The Namesake, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri mined the divides that often open between Bengali immigrants from India and their American-raised children. She stays in this vein in her new collection of short stories, Unaccustomed Earth. In this excerpt, a young woman named Sudha tries to understand why her parents refused to acknowledge her brother Rahul's drinking problem.
Her parents had always been blind to the things that plagued their children, being teased at school for the color of their skin or for the funny things their mother occasionally put into their lunch boxes, potato curry sandwiches that tinted Wonder Bread green. What could there possibly be to be unhappy about, her parents would have thought. Depression was a foreign word to them, an American thing. In their opinion, their children were immune from the hardships and injustices they had left behind in India. As if the inoculations the pediatrician had given Sudha and Rahul when they were babies guaranteed them an existence free of suffering.
That's author Jhumpa Lahiri reading from her new collection of short stories. When she visited our studios recently, she confessed after our talk that she was exhausted and sleep-deprived because she stayed up all night awaiting the New York Times review of her book. She needn't have worried. It was a rave, as were others, and Unaccustomed Earth debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list this week. We asked Jhumpa Lahiri about that title, two words taken from Nathaniel Hawthorne, Unaccustomed Earth.
They're just two beautiful words, aren't they?
And they are.
I was rereading The Scarlet Letter some years ago, and I was working on this book, and just was stunned and struck deeply by those words and by the passage in which that particular phrase appears as really expressing so beautifully and succinctly everything I had lived, everything I was writing about. I think in a way it could be a title for everything I've written and everything I hope I'll write in the future.
Let me read a little of Nathaniel Hawthorne's words. He says, human nature will not flourish any more than a potato if it be planted and replanted for too long a series of generations in the same worn-out soil. My children have had other birthplaces, and so far as their fortunes may be within my control, shall strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. Oh, it's just beautiful. Your unaccustomed earth was, what, Rhode Island?
Rhode Island.
How much of your writing is about you and that experience?
I think all of my writing is coded versions of that experience. They're never my experience directly. I hide behind characters that I invent or put together from other people, and I keep going through it. I think I keep reliving that experience of my parents, their arrival, my upbringing, that collision, that uncertainty, that yearning for feeling rooted and falling short.
Well, so interesting, because like Nathaniel Hawthorne, I bet your parents thought, we are going to give our child the best possible new soil, you know, instead of the soil of India that's, you know, been over and over and over again used. So when somebody does that for you, you can't be unhappy.
Well, they did it, and yet I don't think they ever embraced it in that way. I think there was always a doubt. There was always a worry. There was always the awareness of so much regret and loss and sacrifice that this new soil came at a great cost.
And in this new book, you've written that since becoming a mother yourself, you've said that that gives you insight into what your parents felt. But can it really? Because you have a completely different experience from your mom.
I do, and I did. But I think once you have a child, it does enable you to understand the experience. It certainly makes me appreciate so much more how my parents lived and raised us with so little support compared to what I have. We were related to nobody in entire United States. And to raise children in that type of isolation is something I can't imagine for myself, but they did.
Well, and you do imagine it in some of the stories. I'm thinking of the first story. Maybe you're exploring some of those family ties, Unaccustomed Earth. And it's a young mother who has moved way across the country to the West Coast. She's raising her children at home. Her mother has died. Her father is coming to visit. And part of her is thinking, oh, you know, is he going to want to live with us now? And suddenly something is revealed and she realizes, well, he actually has a life of his own. What am I feeling there in that moment in that mother?
I think she's understanding her father for the first time and in a way loving him most deeply at a point where she realizes he not only doesn't need her in terms of being taken care of, but that she needs him but can't have him. So it's sort of a loss of a parent, more symbolically, I suppose.
Yeah. In a trio of stories that close the book, you have two children of Bengal immigrants who were thrown together when they were young, when the families were thrown together, and then they separate and live their lives, and then they're thrown together again as adults. We've been talking about how the children of Bengal immigrants react to their parents. What are you saying about how they interact to each other in that story?
Well, I think one of the things that I have grown increasingly aware of is the way in which my own social life really differs from the social life of my parents, and the fact that 99.9% of my parents' friends were their friends for a reason. And the reason was that they were also Bengali.
Yeah.
And that was the reason. It made for a very homogeneous world within a world social life for them, and by extension for me when I was very young. And then I grew older and I went to school and I started having some school friends who were usually not Bengali or not even children of Bengali immigrants. And I realized as I got older that friends meant a different thing and do mean a different thing to me. I think those stories are, you know, the two characters in those three stories have led a life in which there's almost a resistance to someone from their parents' world simply because the person is from their parents' world as opposed to their own. And yet they do find each other at a time in life where, because that older generation is now growing older, dying off, there's a sense of that world disappearing. And so they are attracted to each other again, or for the first time. Well, actually, she's attracted to him when she's 13.
But, yeah.
You know, it becomes a more mature, albeit temporary, connection between them.
Yeah. It's interesting because we have people in our office who are children of recent immigrants and people who aren't. And they're responding to some of these issues you raise in the same way. You know, this inability to get through to a parent or to understand a parent's ways. It can be generational, you know, and not necessarily because of an immigrant experience. Are you hearing that?
All along, I've been very grateful and heartened by reactions to my work from people who more or less lived the lives of many of these characters, and then from readers who haven't had that particular type of upbringing and know very little about it. Everyone has felt foreign. Everyone has felt out of place. Everyone has felt estrangement within the generations. Everyone has made crossings in life, even if they've been born and raised and lived and will die in the same town.
Do you see yourself in the future writing, you know, placing a family born and raised in Colorado and having no Bengali heritage? Do you see yourself writing in, you know, completely different characters?
I don't. I mean, you know, I write about what inspires me to write. And this is what inspires me to write and continues to inspire me.
Lucky for us. Writer Jhumpa Lahiri, her new collection of short stories is Unaccustomed Earth. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.